Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. We're going to listen to a short talk by the philosopher David Wasserman from the University of Maryland. He's speaking about genetic engineering and emotional capacity. A wonderfully provocative talk that was part of a panel on genetic engineering and concepts of human nature at the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences meeting on Saturday, September the 3rd, 2005 in Washington, D.C.
Okay, well, I'm going to be talking about the genetic and pharmacological control of emotion and the threat to human nature. And in the time-honored tradition of philosophy talks, I'm going to be reading from my paper. And because I'm nursing cataracts in both eyes, I'm going to be holding that paper very closely. So I apologize in advance for the lack of audience contact. Anyway, when conservative pundits, like those now crowding the bully pulpit of the President's Commission on Bioethics, worry about the threat to human nature from genetic engineering and pharmacology, what are they scared of? The concept of human nature is notoriously vague, and as my colleague Robert Walkbright has noted, it has been invoked as a regulative idea far less often in the past century than in the preceding one. But if it is hard to say what human nature is, it is not hard to identify many of the concerns of those who fear its loss. Some find the prospect of immortality most daunting, but that prospect is remote, and its bearing on essential or characteristic human qualities is speculative and controversial. And while some worry about heightened strength, endurance, memory, and intelligence, most reserve their gravest concern for the loss of characteristic human emotion, especially emotions that are painful or aversive, but that appear to make up much of the rich texture of human lives and deep human relationships. These include sorrow, grief, frustration, and anger, as well as physical pain, which some would not characterize as an emotion. Most of the concern focuses on the threat of abolishing or softening these emotions and sensations, and on the practical and moral consequences of their disappearance or reduction. I will address this concern later, but I think it can be usefully approached by first looking at a related one raised by the prospective use of drugs or genetic engineering to increase the intensity or duration of these emotions in individuals whose experience of them would otherwise be regarded as deficient. Examining this prospect will require us to look at the moral considerations that lead us to regard certain levels of emotion as appropriate and the moral constraints, if any, on artificially producing those levels. In effect, I will invert the question raised by moral expressivism. Can morality be analyzed, and that question is, can morality be analyzed in terms of warranted emotion, e.g., to act wrongly is just to do something that warrants guilt from the agent and anger from his victims or third parties? My interest is in what emotions morality, otherwise analyzed, warrants or even requires. For those who regard emotions as involuntary and who believe that ought implies can, morality cannot command anyone to feel anything. Yet the morality of character, as opposed to action, what Jonathan Bennett calls second-order morality, judges individuals adversely for displaying inappropriate emotions and failing to display appropriate ones. A person who felt no sorrow, or worse, felt joy at the suffering or death of his friends or family would be regarded by many not only psychologically but morally deficient, even if he acted in appropriate ways and out of a sense of duty rather than a fear of censure. Surely, however, someone who was willing to go through the onerous motions of commiseration or mourning without emotional guidance would be willing to take a pill that would cause him to feel the appropriate emotions. Would his sorrow or grief be less of an expression of friendship or love if he had to take a pill to feel it? Or if he had been genetically engineered before birth to acquire the previously missing capacity for grief? These are distinct questions, but those who place a premium on the natural might well be inclined to answer them the same way, to insist that his emotion would be as inauthentic as crocodile tears. I am inclined to disagree, especially in the first case. I would regard drug-induced grief as all the more authentic, an expression of attachment for being willed. Of course, much would depend upon how discriminating the enhanced affect was. If the individual cried at every tribulation in sympathy with colicky babies and frustrated commuters, as well as dying friends, his grief would indeed seem superficial. But if he displayed normal emotional modulation, saving his tears for graver harms and losses, I would regard his emotion as sincere and appropriate. What psychopharmacologists and genetic engineers seek to enhance or reduce is not the feeling itself so much as the susceptibility to feeling. While I will speak of guilt or joy in a pill, this is elliptical. A pill that produced sadness, regardless of context, would just be a downer. Clearly, it is much easier to alter emotion than emotional responsiveness. But much as certain drugs, such as propranolol, can now reduce the affect associated with the memory of traumatic events, if taken closely enough in time to those events, other drugs may someday be able to reduce or increase the affect associated with the experience of traumatic events. The likely development of such drugs and the likely development of genetic engineering to achieve similar effects in the longer term raise two distinctive related issues. The first is the one of what range of emotions is appropriate. Is it inadequate to feel merely a wistful sense of lost opportunities at the death of a close friend in middle age? Is it excessive to feel heartbroken at barely losing the county soccer championship? These are important questions since they are not merely concerned with the etiquette of feelings, what emotion should I wear to the wedding of an ex-spouse, but the role of emotions, particularly strong emotions, in human morality and human flourishing. I will touch briefly on these issues at the end of the talk. For now, I want to focus on the second issue of means or control. Is otherwise apt emotion inappropriate if it's induced in certain ways or deliberately induced in any way? For example, some might think that a person who worked himself up to mourn a friend by listening to lugubrious music had come to his emotion inappropriately, while a person who primed himself for mourning by looking over old letters and photographs had come by it appropriately. It would depend on how relevant the stimulus was to the loss. Others might hold that any attempt to stimulate mourning made the resulting grief inauthentic or counterfeit. As I suggested earlier, I am inclined to think the opposite, that making the effort creates a presumption of authenticity. The desire to feel a certain way, while not the moral equivalent of actually feeling that way, enhances the moral value of the feeling and partially compensates for its absence. It might seem to be a welcome development if drugs could allow us to satisfy such commendable higher order desires. It would help us achieve what Harry Frankfurt has called wholeheartedness, consistency among our higher and lower order desires and attitudes. But the welcome would be mixed, because increased control over our emotional responsiveness would bring with it additional and perhaps oppressive responsibility. The capacity to control our emotional responsiveness would push much of what is now in the morality of character into the morality of action. Though can hardly implies ought, we could no longer disclaim responsibility for what we felt and accept our affect as a reflection of our character beyond our immediate control. Would a cool person who declined to enhance his pain at the suffering and death of his friends show himself to be less of a friend? Should a person who had recently lost a loved one induce more intense grief the more fully to express his love and sense of loss? What if a person came to a bedside or a funeral of a loved one with no sadness, apologizing that he had forgotten his pills? Would we regard him as insensitive, negligent, or both? Similar considerations would would attend the prospect of inducing guilt or remorse. We do not think that these emotions need to be hard won or carefully cultivated. We generally admire people quickly overcome with guilt for their misdeeds, at least when guilt is in proportion to the misdeed. Some misgivings about producing guilt pharmacologically may come from a suspicion that the emotion it would yield would not only be ersatz, but coarse, lacking focus, discrimination, and nuance. for example, vague sadness or embarrassment rather than sharp, specific pangs of remorse. But that would merely represent a failure of pharmacology. Without taking a position in the debate over the cognitive or judgmental character of emotions, it's clear that a drug that made its takers feel sad or uncomfortable after their misdeeds would simply fail to produce the emotion of guilt. It would be more like anabuse for misconduct. Poor approximation, however, does not exhaust the concern about drug-induced guilt. There are also worries about the pill taker's motives. Certainly, a killer who induced guilt to get a lighter sentence from the judge would get no moral credit for that guilt, however strongly it was felt once induced. But a killer who believed that he had done wrong, sought punishment, and took the pill only because he believed he should feel guilt about what he had done would deserve, I think, moral credit for his guilt. As I claimed for grief, the provenance of the emotion is not decisive. While it is admirable in one sense to have a natural constitution that disposed one to feel appropriate guilt, it is admirable in another sense to overcome or circumvent the limits of a less responsive natural constitution by chemical or genetic modification. With anger, we can make the transition from heightening aversive emotion to reducing it. There might be occasions or people for whom it would be appropriate to induce or increase anger. Self-denigrating victims who saw the wrongs done them as their dessert, for example. More often, we would seek to reduce anger, but I suspect we would find many aggrieved people reluctant to let go of their anger pharmacologically, even after they had given it a very long run. Their reluctance might appear to validate the claim that anger is addictive or seductive, or at least the claim that most anger has a kind of wholeheartedness. People who are angry about something may typically want to be angry about it and would therefore be reluctant to give up their anger even when that required nothing more than taking a pill. The same may be true for guilt. Those who feel it, however excessively or inappropriately, may also feel that they should feel it. So they would be very reluctant to reduce it pharmacologically. Fear, gloom, dread, anxiety, and kindred emotions are among the most likely to be subject to reduction. Indeed, they already are. All but a few naive or cruel romantics regard chronically high levels of all of these emotions as undesirable. We may admire individuals who overcome fear more than those who do not feel it. But most consider the reduced opportunity to defy fear as a small price to pay for a general reduction in fear. Perhaps some people are attached to their fears. More may be attached to the pessimistic worldviews that accompany depression. But sales of Prozac and other SSRIs suggest that most people are willing to let go of their depressions, to substitute a life of sometimes jarring emotional variety for one of flat, gloomy affect. That preference has the blessing of conservatives, who see the reduction of fear and depression, at least up to a point, as therapeutic, and view therapy as either somehow more natural than enhancement or as a clear exception to the ban on artificial intervention. But drug companies and consumers will not stop at the reduction of abnormal levels of fear, anxiety, and gloom. Life would be easier, brighter, and more open if it were less encumbered by fear, anxiety, and gloom than most of us are now. And life would certainly be much more pleasant without the physical pain all of us experience at certain times. Confident that they can rely on their common sense to keep them from reckless adventures and hot stoves, many people would opt for a life with levels of fear and pain far below those now considered normal. What then of the prospect, welcomed by transhumanists, of drugs or engineering that would make people far happier than they are and that would virtually abolish pain, sorrow, grief, and frustration? Enthusiasts for such abolition tend to regard those with misgivings as either timorous, afraid that people who do not feel pain and sorrow would not be alert to physical and social threats, or worse, as begrudging, willing to deny future generations far happier lives out of sheer envy. That dismissal is far too sweeping, if not entirely groundless. Worries about the behavioral impact of ceasing to feel pain, fear, and anxiety cannot be brushed aside with the assurance that people would still be able to track physical and social threats without them. That assurance seems to display unwarranted optimism. But even if we didn't need to worry about behavior, we should be concerned about less tangible threats to the quality of our lives. We might worry that friendship and love would become superficial if they could no longer deeply wound, that our joy would become shallow without the prospect of sorrow. These are not strictly empirical concerns, although evidence about the lives of people with widely varying emotional constitutions might be relevant to them. But these concerns are as close as any I have encountered to explaining the fear that genetic engineering could fundamentally alter human nature and that this would be a bad thing. I obviously can't do justice to these concerns here, and I will conclude only by stressing that however valid they may be, they do not raise doubts about the intranormal emotional modifications I have spent most of this talk addressing. Thank you. Thank you, David.
That was a talk by David Wasserman, a philosopher at the University of Maryland, called Genetic Engineering and Emotional Capacity, part of the Association for Politics and the Life Sciences meetings in Washington, D.C. on September the 3rd, 2005. Yesterday, a subscriber to the WTA talk list noted when he was searching for a possible upside to Katrina that for a huge majority of these disadvantaged citizens, they have the attention of all levels of government like never before. The thought is uncomfortably close to Barbara Bush's clueless, "they're better off now" comment, but I confess that I've had the same thought, partly because I have long admired a book by Nicholas Lehman called The Promised Land, which was based on William Julius Wilson's work on the underclass. Wilson and Lehman argued that geographic and social isolation of the urban underclass had been created by desegregation, middle-class blacks leaving the inner cities in particular, and deindustrialization. Looking back at the experience of FDR's CCC programs, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which got poor whites out of poverty and spread them all over the country planting trees, Wilson and Lehman proposed that a massive set of government work programs, building vital physical infrastructure like levees, or working in human service professions like nursing homes, could get people out of their isolated ghettos, break the cycle of urban poverty, and improve the security of the nation. This tragedy could then indeed be an opportunity for such a change in life situation for the displaced poor. Unfortunately, the United States is now controlled by plutocrats and anti-statist ideologues who think that tax cuts are the solution to all social ills. So while the coastal disaster has spread hundreds of thousands of poor people across the U.S., it is unlikely that this administration will commit to the relocation efforts, jobs and education programs, or physical infrastructure investments necessary to keep them from remaining stuck in poverty. Before Katrina, Louisiana and Mississippi were two of the poorest, sickest, and least educated states in the United States, ranking with countries in the developing world. And in 5 years, I think they probably still will be. Sadly, I also read in this week's New Yorker a piece by Nicholas Lehman, who it turns out is a New Orleanian and whose parents have had to leave behind their home there. He's pretty depressed. But in an accompanying interview, he does echo one sentiment that I'm hearing a lot. This is the beginning of the end for the anti-statist phase of our political cycle, as the 1927 New Orleans flood helped pave the way for the New Deal. The New Yorker asked him, "Is this whole experience going to make people lose faith in government?" Lehman answered, "I certainly hope not. I hope it'll have the exact opposite effect, starting with Reagan's inauguration in 1981 when he said that government is the problem. I think we've been conditioned to believe that government is this kind of vague, ill-defined thing that does all this wasteful, stupid stuff, that nobody really needs it. This should be a moment that wakes people up to the need for a government that works. There's no way to deal with this kind of thing without the federal government, as we're seeing. So if we and the world are lucky, we may see progressives elected in the United States in the 2006 and 2008 elections who will start to reinvest in people and infrastructure instead of the military-industrial complex. How does all this then relate to techno-progressivism, to the singularity and the emerging technologies? A key techno-progressive issue is the structural unemployment likely to emerge from economic globalization and automation. One of the key techno-progressive proposals is a basic income guarantee to address both structural unemployment and the emerging old age dependency ratios that are attendant to life extension. But one of the key debates in social policy, at least on the left, has been about the relative utility of jobs programs and workfare versus welfare and basic income. The jobs and workfare side have argued that, A, the quid pro quo of money for work gives people dignity and reduces their dysfunctional behavior, TV watching, baby making, crack smoking, and so on. B, that it addresses unmet social needs. And C, that it is much more politically palatable than simple money for nothing. I think each of these arguments has merit, which is why we need to defend and expand labor-intensive government spending on health, education, and infrastructure programs, and on job training for jobs available in the private sector, at the same time that we build support for a basic income guarantee. Of course, we will still face the situation that, at some point, a robotic tree planter displaces 10 human tree planters, a nanobot injection displaces a home care nursing team, and a robotic levee builder displaces 10 construction workers. So basic income guarantees still need to be front and center on our agenda, even as we struggle today to provide jobs, housing, education, and a new, more sustainable coastal economy and infrastructure for the victims of Katrina. Regular listeners to Change Surfer Radio are no doubt aware of the Cyborg Democracy blog at cyborgdemocracy.net, and that a number of us who have gathered there have begun to discuss techno-progressivism as a way to frame some of the ideas that we've been developing over the years, ideas that I call in Citizen Cyborg, my book, democratic transhumanist ideas, but which not everyone's comfortable with as a term, a set of terms. And so techno-progressivism has emerged as one of these terms that people seem to be attracted to. And we've started also now the technoliberation.net website and the techno-liberation discussion list on Yahoo groups to organize and think about some of the ideas from these techno-progressive perspectives. I want to read you the mission statement of the techno-liberation website and of the techno-progressive list, because it frames some of the concerns that you might want to engage with us there about. Techno-liberation, using technology to deepen democracy, using democracy to ensure technology benefits us all. Techno-liberation is a welcoming space for conversation, collaboration, organization, and debate among liberal, social, and radical Democrats from around the world, all of whom share the sense that emerging, converging, disruptive global technological developments threaten unprecedented harm, while they promise unprecedented emancipation for humanity. We want to think about the ways in which technology provokes us to rethink and reimagine the left wing of the possible. Techno-liberation is a rainbow coalition that extends beyond the visible spectra. Our participants belong to different communities, work on different problems, bring different histories, temperaments, and hopes to the work we share, emphasize different pieces of the techno-progressive puzzle. We are gathered together to trade ideas, tell stories, make plans, mobilize efforts, identify threats, facilitate progressive developmental outcomes, and share our differences. Many of us are post-naturalist greens and champions of sustainable development. Many of us are secular humanists and post-humanist humanitarians. Many of us are pro-choice feminists and morphological freedom fighters, defending consensual personal genetic, prosthetic, and cognitive practices of self-creation. Many of us are atheists, aesthetes, and non-judgmental people of many faiths and spiritual practices. Many of us are transgendered, queer theorists, biopunks, democratic transhumanists, and psychedelic experimentalists. Many of us are copy fighters, defenders of the creative and genomic commons, enthusiasts of social software tools, free software, open source, peer-to-peer democracy. Many of us are policy wonks, technocrats, world federalists, human rights activists, election reformers, advocates of basic income guarantees and universal health care, leapfroggers, and space enthusiasts. Many of us are champions of consensual science, of genetic science, and evolutionary theory, But none of us are genetic determinists or social Darwinists. None of us are all of these things, of course, but many of us are many of them. And we are all of us inspired and provoked by the connections we find among these struggles and celebrations. Bioconservatives, market libertarians, religious fundamentalists, and retrofuturists are not welcome among us. There are plenty of places, online and off, where we can argue with you, just as there are plenty of occasions to contemplate the real-world consequences of your ideas and values. Techno-liberation is not the place for you. Feel free to listen and lurk and learn, but pick your fights with us elsewhere. This is a safe space for techno-progressives of all kinds and commitments. We are focused here on the extraordinary threats and promises of ongoing and upcoming technological transformations of what has come to be thought of as the human condition. We are all champions of democracy here, and we are all progressives. We are techno-progressives, and we demand nothing short of techno-liberation. This is a bit of Dale Carrico's definition of techno-progressivism and its converse, bioconservatism. Techno-progressivism assumes that technological developments can be empowering and emancipatory so long as they are regulated by legitimate, democratic, and accountable authorities to ensure that their costs, risks, and benefits are all fairly shared by the actual stakeholders to those developments. Techno-progressivism is a stance of support for such technological development in general and for consensual human practices of genetic, prosthetic, and cognitive modification in particular. Bioconservatism, on the other hand, is a stance of hesitancy about technological development in general and tends to maintain a strong opposition to the genetic, prosthetic, or cognitive modification of human beings in particular. Whether arising from a conventionally right-leaning politics of religious and cultural conservatism or from a conventionally left-leaning politics of environmentalism, bioconservative positions oppose medical and other technological interventions into what are broadly perceived as current human and cultural limits in the name of defense of the natural deployed as a moral category. The Techno-Liberation site is named after a poem from Greg Egan, a science fiction writer, from his book Distress, and this is a poem that inspires a political movement called techno-liberation in that book. Techno-liberation. It is not true that the map of freedom will be complete with the erasure of the last invidious border. When it remains for us to chart the attractors of thunder and delineate the arrhythmias of drought, to reveal the molecular dialects of forest and savanna as rich as 1,000 human tongues, and to comprehend the deepest history of our passions, ancient beyond mythology's reach. So I declare that no corporation holds a monopoly on numbers, no patent can encompass zero and one, no nation has sovereignty over adenine and guanine, no empire rules the quantum waves, and there must be room for all at the celebration of understanding, for there is a truth which cannot be bought or sold, imposed by force, resisted or escaped. Again, that's Greg Egan in his novel Distress. And you can find the techno-liberation list on Yahoo Groups and technoliberation.net. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.